Hello again, and welcome back to Food Toxicology. Last time, if you recall, we visited the subject of food allergy. And what we tried to do is introduce a very complex subject in a fairly compacted sense, and so that you get a sense of, in terms of the consequences of some of these immune-mediated responses to the chemicals that occur in food. Naturally occurring chemicals primarily, in some cases modifications in terms of the cooking process, biological processes in terms of infectious or bacterial infections associated with food, or in some cases food additives. In today's lecture, what we're going to do is try to talk about food intolerance and food-related metabolic disorders as other aspects of these classifications of adverse food reactions. Our learning objectives here today, what we're going to try to do is understand the range of food intolerance and metabolic disorders related to food consumption. We're going to try to explore as one of the prime sort of food intolerance issues, celiac disease, the occurrence and mechanism of that particular disease manifestation. We're going to try to understand some of the major classes of food sensitivity. We're going to try to survey some examples of food sensitivity and metabolic intolerance. Obviously, we're not going to be doing every metabolic disorder associated with food, just the major categories. We'll try to examine what's referred to as idiosyncratic food sensitivity, where in fact we find the relationship between a food chemical and an individual is somewhat case-by-case basis. Well, one of the classes that we have talked about in terms of food sensitivity is classical food allergy. And this typically is associated as a protein and an allergic response or immune-mediated response to a food chemical. What we're going to try to do is talk about some other aspects in terms of reactions and food disorders, including anaphylactoid reactions, metabolic food disorders, idiosyncratic reactions. And one thing I want to make sure that you understand is that although we'll categorize these adverse food reactions, sometimes particular sensitivities will cross over in terms of categorization. So our attempts to identify primary mechanisms are perhaps laudable, but perhaps not in total correctness how the disease manifests itself. In terms of one of the diseases of major concern in terms of food intolerance is a syndrome called celiac disease, associated with celiac sprue, or a whole complement of digestive upset problems associated with gluten sensitivity. This is a fairly widespread in terms of its incidence in the U.S. population, about 1 in 3,000 incidents, so it's relatively common. It's one of the most common food sensitivities that will cross your range of experience, I would imagine. It is not IgE-mediated. There is some suggestion in terms of the research that it is a type 4 delayed type hypersensitivity, and that there is some cellular and immune cell interactions in terms of the presentation of this disease. It's delayed, and then typically individuals with this disease condition will have about a 24 to 72 hour exposure delay between exposure of the food and the onset of symptoms. And so this gives us a sense that this is a little bit more complex presentation than some of the more immediate food allergy responses. It typically does not involve abnormal immunity or atopy, as we discussed in food allergy, where people that are allergic to a whole range or cluster of things. Quite often, celiac disease can present in people who have very limited allergies or dermatitis sorts of conditions. In terms of celiac disease, we find that ingestion of wheat, barley, and rye, which has some proline-rich proteins, gliadins, will actually trigger some sort of immune damage to the small intestine. Again, a cascading of response, and you'll hear me use that term often in food allergy and food sensitivity, that essentially one range of reactions breeds another set of reactions and a cascade of responses. I can talk, in fact, in own personal consequences of observing a cascading poison ivy response, where the poison ivy was on the individual's arm, but in fact started getting welts at other parts of the body that were actually covered in this cascading immune response. Celiac disease impairs absorption of nutrients, and so this can be a pretty significant disease manifestation. In terms of the symptoms, diarrhea, bloating, weight loss, bone pain, anemia, some chronic fatigue, cramps, and weakness. What we find in celiac disease is we trace it to chromosome 6. It's an inherited trait, so parents that have celiac disease will be looking for it in their children. The classification of this in terms of an adverse food reaction is best perhaps called an idiosyncratic reaction, but it does involve an immune component. So it's a little bit more complex than some of the other allergic reactions that we've talked about in lecture. Another anaphylactoid reaction or adverse food reaction involving anaphylaxis, localized quite often, is scomboid poisoning. This results from eating fish with high histamine levels. Some of the common fish types are tuna, mackerel. The histamine comes from spoilage bacteria in the fish, and so HACCP is a big concern in terms of the transportation and processing of fish products from the catch to the table. Everyone is susceptible, so there is a broad range of response, so it's the question, perhaps this isn't an allergy, but it's just a toxicant, and it's exposure to histamine and the consequences in terms of our reactivity to that particular chemical. It has the same symptoms as a food allergy, but there is no IgE induction in this particular reaction. In terms of scomboid toxicosis, other factors besides histamine in the fish may actually exacerbate the reaction. Some of these are putrefactive amines, putrescine, cadaverine are some of those compounds. The odor-causing amine generations associated with dead meat. There can be some relationship with the histamine inhibitors, aminoquinine, isoniazid are two of them. Some of these oxidase inhibitors may be associated with scrombotoxicosis. FDA does have a food action level in terms of histamine as 50 milligrams per 100 grams of fish, and I've put the chemical structure of histamine on here for you to give you an idea of what we're dealing with in scrombotoxicosis. What we find is that scrombotoxicosis, the disease symptomology, can occur in the absence of high histamine, and so there must be a complement of other compounds that also associate with high histamine in the same processes that cause histamine, but not necessarily in a parallel fashion. This might be the result of increased intake of some biogenic amines, such as scrombotoxin, the structure that's at the bottom of this particular slide. We also find that there might be some increased synthesis of biogenic amines by gut flora associated with fish consumption, and also diminished breakdown of some of these amines by the gut mucosa. And so perhaps a little bit of multiple level processing in terms of the relationship of the chemicals in fish and the presentation of disease. This is a case study from Pennsylvania, 1998, scomboid fish poisoning. This is not necessarily a common poisoning, but it is more common than some others. Now with HACCP and management of the food system, it is perhaps in the past few decades less common than maybe it once was. In this particular case, this is December 3rd, 1998, four adults were out at a restaurant and they ate a spinach tuna salad at a restaurant. Their symptoms included a burning sensation in the mouth, metallic taste, facial flushing, nausea, diarrhea, sweating, and headache. The symptoms occurred about 5 minutes to 2 hours after eating the salad. One was taken to the local emergency department and treated with epinephrine. The other three patients were examined and released. The presumptive diagnosis was scromboid fish poisoning based on clinical and epidemiological presentation of this particular case. In terms of the follow-up analysis, in terms of the public health authorities in Pennsylvania, sample of the remaining fish was actually taken to the laboratory. It did test positive for coliform and E. coli, and the histamine test indicated that greater than 50 parts per million of histidine was histamine was actually present in the fish tissue, whereas about 10 parts per million is the normal concentration of this compound in fish. This followed up with an investigation of looking at the wholesale to retail chain of events in the particular destinations of this food product. This particular analysis, all the way from the catching of the fish, the type of fish, and its storage along the way, actually all appeared to be within HACCP guidelines in terms of temperature maintenance of the food product. And so there was no HACCP violation. About all the investigators could come up with was perhaps that this particular mechanism, method of fishing, long line fishing, where the line is out so far that the fish gets hooked and perhaps struggles and perhaps maybe even drowns on line, might be a more risky, more hazardous way in terms of managing a fish product. And so there was at least a call a little bit for a follow-up investigation of this method of catch versus others and its presentation of scromboid fish poisoning. In terms of anaphylactoid reactions, strawberry allergy is one of these categories. This is an allergy that has been relatively difficult in terms of laboratory study. It does have anaphylactoid and rash presentation, urticaria. No allergen has been identified in strawberries. Strawberries do not contain histamine. There is a release of endogenous histamine upon eating, and so there is the potential for some reaction, but it does not appear to be IgE mediated in terms of being a true food allergy. Food sensitivities is another category of adverse food reactions. The two best known food sensitivities are lactose intolerance and favism. We'll explore favism in terms of natural food, natural plant toxins in a lecture later on in the semester. In terms of metabolic food disorders, typically these are genetically determined disorders. It affects the host ability to metabolize food, for instance, in lactose intolerance. There are altered metabolic patterns that enhances host sensitivity to a particular chemical. In the case of favism, it's to the oxidative chemicals that are in legumes of certain types. Celiac disease could also be classified, another cross-classification aspect, as a metabolic food disorder. Lactose intolerance individuals, they lack a beta-galactosidase enzyme, or lactase enzyme. It metabolizes this particular enzyme, lactose to glucose, and galactose in the intestinal mucosa. What happens is lactose cannot be metabolized, and therefore bacteria in the colon break this down to CO2, hydrogen, and H2O, so a lot of gas and bloating associated with the consumption of dairy products. This ends up in a manifestation of abdominal cramping and flatulence, frothy diarrhea, a very uncomfortable food disorder, lactose intolerance. Its occurrence is about 6 to 12% in Caucasians, about 60 to 90% in Arabs, Greeks, Jews, Black Americans, Hispanics, and Japanese individuals. It can occur in children, but more commonly it occurs in adults. It typically is more severe in adults as well. Lactase is in the gut at birth, and it may decrease with age in terms of enhancing susceptibility in older adults. Secondary lactose intolerance is caused by some other intestinal problems, and it's sometimes associated with failure to absorb lactose. It can be a response of a previous condition of viral gastroenteritis, some intestinal damage. If there is a disease condition, an illness condition of the gut that does heal, sometimes the secondary lactose intolerance does disappear after this particular healing. One of the ways we diagnose lactose intolerance is with a lactose tolerance test. This involves an oral administration of lactose to a fasting person, so it's isolated. They measure the blood glucose and the breath hydrogen as the byproducts of this particular biometabolism. They monitor GIT symptoms to see if there's bloating, discomfort, the associated clinical symptoms associated with lactose intolerance. Some of the problems associated with the lactose tolerance test has a lot to do with the relatively high dose. 50 grams is equal to a liter of milk. It's a significant dose. In lactose tolerance, many people can handle smaller doses of lactose. More recent tests use a smaller dose or gradually increasing dose as a diagnostic tool. Some people have normal lactase levels, but for various idiosyncratic reasons, they're still intolerant and demonstrate some lactose intolerance. The way lactose intolerance is treated is primarily by avoidance of dairy products, and it may not be that complete avoidance is needed depending upon the sensitivity of the individual. Small divided doses of milk are sometimes acceptable. There can be an addition of lactase to the milk or other enzymes or bacteria that, such as acidophilus milk, that have lactase that assist in the digestion process. Another form of metabolic food disorder is called favism. This results from an inherited deficiency of glucose 6-phosphate dehydrogenase enzyme in red blood cells. This can have dramatic consequences following the ingestion of certain broad beans like fava beans or somehow breathing the pollen of these beans that contain the same sorts of proteins. The disease manifestation is hemolytic anemia. This can again have serious consequences and potentially multi-organ failure. Some of the other symptoms: pallor, fatigue, shortness of breath, nausea, abdominal pain, and fever. In favism, what happens, these particular fava beans have some oxidants, visine and convisine. These particular oxidants will oxidize tissues and cells. The G6-PDH is critical to red blood cell synthesis, and so there is an imbalance associated with the oxidative imbalance and oxidative damage to these red blood cells. In terms of the occurrence of favism, this is the most common enzyme defect in human population. Globally, about 100 million people suffer from this particular metabolic disorder. In broad categories, it occurs in Asians, Jews, Sardinians, Cypriot, Greeks, African blacks. It does not occur in Caucasians to any degree, American Indians, or Eskimos, and so there is seems to be a racial cultural divide there in terms of the occurrence of favism. It's more common in males and females, and it's more severe in infants and children in terms of the presentation of disease. Other metabolic disorders include the sulfur-smelling urine following consumption of asparagus that affects some people. This comes from the inability to metabolize one of the sulfur compounds, methanthiol, which is then excreted in urine, giving it that significant smell. There are other compounds, I will tell you, in asparagus that do have smells, and so it's something that is kind of part of our own individual bioprocessing. Other metabolic disorders include red wine sensitivity, where the individual experiences sneezing, itching, flushing, headache, shortness of breath. Some of that is associated with impaired histamine degradation, some possible diamine oxidase deficiencies associated with the individual as well. Other metabolic disorders include betinuria or beturia, which is a disease associated or metabolic associated with the inability to process the red coloring in beets. It yields red urine. This is not a necessarily a disease, other than the fact red urine is upsetting to many individuals because it may be an indicator of kidney failure. And so people that get a surprising discovery that they have this particular disorder are sometimes get overly concerned about other diseases. I read one statistic that about 15% of the population in the UK have beturia and experience this particular condition. Another metabolic disorder may have to do with phenylethylamine metabolism and chocolate sensitivity and chocolate bringing on migraine headaches. There's fructose intolerance that yields some gastrointestinal tract problems, and hypoglycemia may be resulting from reduced hepatic catalase enzymes. Some other food sensitivities can be classified as idiosyncratic reactions. The mechanisms are unknown. Some of these reactions, some of these sensitivities are actually well documented, like sulfite sensitivity. Some of them are anecdotal, where there's only weak evidence, and that's, for instance, yellow dye or MSG, monosodium glutamate sensitivity, and we'll talk about some of these in our food additive lectures here in this course. Many of these are disproved, but there is some popular belief out there about food sensitivities and reactivity of some of the additives in food products. Some food coloring especially seem to be disproved, but still have some popular belief that there is a sensitivity out there. The proven idiosyncratic reactions in terms of adverse food reactions include sulfites and its relationship to asthma, celiac disease and the relationship to cereal products, and aspartame reactivity leading to urticaria or rashes. Some of the unproven idiosyncratic reactions include rashes associated with BH, BHT, BHA, and benzoate preservatives, the relationship of asthma and rashes to yellow dye number 5, the relationship of aspartame to migraine headaches, the relationship of sugar to aggressive behavior, and the relationship of MSG, monosodium glutamate, to Chinese restaurant syndrome and asthma. In terms of the idiosyncratic reactions that have been disproved in terms of clinical study, hypokinesis in children, hyperactive children, being somewhat related to food coloring agents in the diet has been disproven. In terms of food additive relationships to hypersensitivity that have been confirmed are sulfite food additives. What these compounds do is they prevent enzymatic and non-enzymatic browning of food. So it has been used historically in salad bars. It does have antimicrobial antioxidant properties. It's used as a dough conditioner, as a bleaching agent, for instance, in maraschino cherries and in hominy. Sulfite-induced asthma is triggered by exposure to sulfites. There's an acute onset in the order of minutes. It can be severe. There have been deaths that have been documented associated with sulfite-induced asthma. Its use on salad bars has been banned. Lettuce is a problem because lettuce naturally has a relatively high free sulfite level. Natural levels in the human diet, however, are quite low. In terms of sulfite additives in foods for people that are sensitive or have sulfite sensitivity, Dried raisins and prunes have levels of about 500 to 2,000 parts per million. Lemon-lime juices, 150 to 800 parts per million. Grape juice, 50 to 250 parts per million. Wine, 20 to 350 parts per million. Molasses, 125. And shrimp, and 10 to 100. The FDA has ordered that products in excess of 10 parts per million must have the label contain sulfites. You'll see this occasionally on wine bottles, for example. In sulfite asthma, the mechanism, it does span the anaphylactoid, metabolic, and idiosyncratic classes of adverse food reactions. There is some IgE mediation of the response. There is some evidence of a sulfite oxidase deficiency. And we also find a respiratory hypersensitivity to inhaled sulfur dioxide. Individual tolerance in terms of exposure to sulfite varies significantly, the range being 3 to perhaps 130 milligrams of exposure. Another food additive that has been explored in terms of idiosyncratic adverse food reaction is tartrazine. This is a case of induced asthma and rashes. Tartrazine is FD&C yellow dye number 5. There's been reports of asthma and rashes in children. FDA required labeling in 1979, and there have been numerous product recalls because of the failure to list on the label that this particular dye is used in the food product. There have been some problems associated with tartrazine-induced asthma in rashes. There was no effects observed on follow-up double-blind studies. Withholding medications like bronchial inhalers seem to discount the effects as well. There are a range of similar problems with other food additive studies and the associated presentation of rashes, primarily in flawed design of the studies. And so the consequences of this is there's no clear picture of the relationship of these compounds and food reaction. Food additives and chronic rashes, what we find in terms of anecdotal relationships and observed relationships, FD&C yellow dye number 5, sunset yellow, FD&C number 6, sodium benzoate, benzoic acid, parabens, BHA, BHT, the suspect in terms of the cause-effect relationship for these compounds is very suspect. With that, that kind of ends our relationship of food to the immune system and the immune consequences in terms of adverse food reactions. What we've tried to do is demonstrate, again, a cause-effect relationship in the classical toxicology side sense of the allergens and the immune-mediated responses associated with food allergy, and then some of the other consequences associated with adverse food reactions, including various types of metabolic disorders and idiosyncratic sensitivities. Next time, what we'll try to do is explore follow-up in terms of some of these food additives, and as well in a further lecture look at biotechnology and its presentation of what one might regard as a foreign substance, a new substance in a food product, and how that might have a relationship to the presentation of food allergy. Until that time, we'll see you all later. Thanks so much.